Court will proceed to the second case of the day. A quarter-hour band of Lake Superior and Chippewa Indians et al. Versus the United States et al. Mr. Freiberg.
Good morning. My name is Robert Freiberg with A Source World, representing the appellants in this case, the three Chippewa tribes. The case involves the validity of the governor veto section of the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act with respect to off-reservation gaming. According to the government, Congress has not created any intelligible principle for controlling the governor's decision. It's a very rare case where the government says there's no intelligible principle. If they are correct, Congress has delegated more unguided authority to the governor than they could delegate to the executive branch. If they are correct, the Wisconsin legislature is probably, they've delegated more power to the governor than the Wisconsin legislature could, because the Wisconsin legislature, like most legislatures, cannot delegate uncontrolled discretionary power. If the government is correct, this statute violates core principles of separation of powers and federalism. Federalism, because it rearranges the way the state makes a policy decision. It conscripts the governor into a final federal decision-making process.
Mr. Freiberg, aren't you really asking us to create a circuit split with the Ninth Circuit?
No. Because the Ninth Circuit was not informed by Prince. Prince was decided after the Ninth Circuit decision, and federalism was really...
Is it your view that Prince overruled Tsilis Indians?
Pardon?
Is it your view that Prince overrules Tsilis?
Silas.
Silas.
What
I'm
saying
sorry.
Is the Ninth Circuit did not really address federalism issues, so there's no, this court can proceed without saying Silas was wrong on federalism grounds, and taking a look at Prince. Indeed, when the Silas tribe petitioned the United States Supreme Court for certiorari, the government responded by saying that there were no federalism issues preserved. Then the petition for cert was on Prince grounds, and the government, and I think correctly, stated that there were no federalism issues presented in the Silas case. So this court can proceed to find a violation of federalism without disagreeing with the Silas court because of Prince. The separation of powers issue is because Congress has delegated power to make the law.
Forgive me, I don't really want to interrupt, but you're saying that the Ninth Circuit did not reject your position on the separation of powers and the Appointments Clause argument?
No, I'm saying the Ninth Circuit did not really reach the federalism argument.
All right.
It certainly reached the delegation in some respects, relying exclusively on a proposition for unmade ever by any court that Congress can create contingent legislation to upset the structure of state government.
So if I thought that the federalism arguments are perhaps the repackaging of the separation of powers and appointments clause arguments, I would just be flat out wrong.
It's a very different concept, and Prince said so. It's not a separation of powers. It is separation of powers is chadha. Chadha is when the structure of the government was to the effect that the Congress was trying to displace the core function of the presidency by overturning an executive position. That is a separation of powers claim issue. This, we have that in this case. But a federalism claim is when Congress, in this case, also not only tried to displace the presidency, but in the argument that was really not explored in depth by the Ninth Circuit, if at all, is that the Congress has changed the structure of state government. And they can't do that, period. They cannot, on a federalism grounds, say, pick out one state official and say, you, governor, will make the policy for us in the state of Wisconsin. The governor
The state legislature is not happy with the governor having his say on this matter. Why can't the state legislature act and just forbid the governor to deal with the Congress on this matter?
Well, they've tried twice with two different governors, and the governors have vetoed their rule, their proposed legislation.
But they can't the legislature override those vetoes?
They can, but I don't think Congress would, in this bill, and this act, allows the legislature to displace the power of the governor.
The United States wants to talk to somebody in the state about this. Okay, so the United States says, all right, we're going to talk to the head of the executive branch, executive to executive. Isn't it then up to the legislature of Wisconsin to do something about it if it doesn't like the arrangement?
This is more than talk. This is decision.
That's right.
This is a decision. I don't believe what you've just suggested is that the federal government can empower the governor and that the legislature can try and strip them of that power.
And if they do, then when the secretary contacts them, he has to say, I'm sorry, Mr. Secretary, I have been forbidden by the people of Wisconsin to reply to that.
I would respond to that in two ways. First of all, Congress said, we're going to ask the governor, we empower the governor. And secondly, and more importantly, for federalism purposes, it flips on its head the way state policy is made. The policy is made by the legislature in the first instance, not the legislature. He's not trying to take it away from the governor.
Did the Congress require the governor to answer? Is the governor under any obligation to answer the inquiry of the secretary?
The governor, under this scheme, is the final decision maker. If he has three choices, the same as any other veto provision of the president or governors.
What if the statute were written so that if the governor refused to take any action, the secretary's will would be the final answer? Would that solve the problem?
The governor cannot be the final decision maker, and it wouldn't solve the problem. No. It would not solve the problem.
If he or she simply refused to answer the...
If she refuses, or he refuses, in this case it's a he, to a he,
sure,
refuses to answer the question, then the governor is sitting on the matter. Same as a governor who sits on a bill and doesn't sign it, doesn't veto it. Depending on the time, it either has an impact, it either goes into effect or doesn't go into effect. In this case, if the governor did nothing, the application would still be open. Open. Because it is only when the governor denied the application that the secretary, in just total reliance on what the governor did, denied the application solely on that ground. If the governor did nothing, the application would go to the next governor, as it just did in Louisiana on another one of these matters. There is no way the governor can avoid being the final decision maker. He makes the final decision. Even by sitting on it, the application is in limbo. And that is a final decision, or certainly it's a decision. It's not an invitation. It's not a would you please. It's a decision power given to the governor. And it's a decision that he did not get from the Wisconsin legislature.
Are you suggesting, Mr. Freeberg, that if the statute suggested it required a vote of the legislature, piece of legislation, that it would be okay?
No, wouldn't be okay.
Your position is it can't incorporate any policy decision by the executive or the legislature of a state.
You could incorporate them, but not in the context of a federal administrative executive.
Well, how would you incorporate that? What would be a hypothetical?
Hypothetical is that with respect to off-reservation gaming, we leave it up to the states to control. Period. Such as, there are laws like that, such as the United States bans interstate transportation of gambling paraphernalia or gambling information, except for those states that allow gaming. Mm-hmm. That is a classic non-delegation decision by Congress, because all Congress is saying is that within the context of its powers to regulate interstate commerce, I really apologize for that.
Do you need to take a drink?
I'm not sure it would help.
Okay.
That within its powers to regulate interstate commerce, it is not regulating at all in a particular area and leaving that up to the states. That's not a delegation issue, and it's not an empowerment of the state.
It's not an empowerment?
No.
That's really a play on words, isn't it?
Oh, no, that's all over the cases.
Well, I understand, but just let's be frank about empowerment. When you allow the state that option, what's the difference?
The difference is that the state already has the power to regulate under its police powers. The only reason why it cannot regulate is because the federal government, through its control of interstate commerce, can stop it. If the government of the United States withdraws, the power was always there, but it had to been displaced by a superior government. That's why it's not a delegation. The power was always there. It's the same way that Native American tribes can be empowered. They always are, as a nation, can regulate the conduct on their reservations. So if the United States withdraws, it's from its Indian Commerce Clause ability to regulate. That doesn't, it's not a delegation. They always had the power. They can now, they're not displaced by a superior power. So that is a way that the government could do this. But in this case, first of all, we're not dealing with the legislature. We're dealing with one state official. But in this case, this is a decision by the Secretary of Interior, and his decision becomes a mere recommendation to the governor. This flips the separation of powers on its head. It displaces the presidency, the unitary necessity of the executive branch of government, and makes it subordinate to one state official. And that's right, by the way, I think the Ninth Circuit is not at all wrong.
State official can't act unless the secretary initiates the process.
Sure, neither. But the secretary, in a unitary federalism theory, unitary executive, cannot be restrained from making decisions. That is CHADA, which could have had the same thing. Well, the Attorney General's decision is a mere review by both houses of the Congress. It's a structural issue. And once you get into a structural issue, there is no ifs, ands, or buts, or niceties about it. If it violates core powers such as this, that's it. And that's what we have here. I mean, structural, not only structural in the federal government, but this is structural with respect to the state government. The governor has been picked to make policy for the United States and the state of Wisconsin. He gets that from the United States, not from the legislature, who is designed to make policy. That is absolutely clear. Just and to say that this governor can be picked is to destroy the structure of the state government, not all at once, but little by each, one step at a time. And it's just these kinds of structural challenges that Prince said no to. Another issue that was not addressed or even raised, and by the way, this contingent legislation discussion, which is all over the briefs, has never been really applied in a structural governmental setting, whereas Cachada certainly could have been decided that way, that it's just a contingent decision by the Attorney General, which can be upset by one house of the Congress. When you get into structural issues, there has never been a case, except possibly for the Ninth Circuit, which has said that you can have contingent legislation which upsets the balance of relationships in a structural way. This case is federalism as well as separation of powers, and in that situation, what we have here is to say, well, we can use contingent legislation to upset the structure of state government, which is exactly what we had here. Exactly. The government gets empowered by the Congress, and the legislature is essentially helpless to change that. That is backwards. That is not how policy is made in Wisconsin or any state or the United States of America. It is the legislative branch that makes policy. The governor is the executive.
And no governor initiates policy, would you say?
Well, sure, they initiate policy. If he could initiate policy, like the president, if it's part of the core function.
Submission of a budget, for example. Is there policy? Is there the submission of a budget?
But they submit it, but it's not a final decision. It's got to go through the meat grinder of the legislative process. He's just one.
He's not an appointed figure, though. This is somebody who has been elected by all the eligible voters of the state of Wisconsin or any state.
Sure.
So it's not like an agency head that, the secretary, whatever might be the equivalent, let's say, of a secretary of the interior in a state. It's not a gubernatorial appointee. It is somebody who's reflective of the popular will to a certain extent.
I think that's worse because it's structural. If you're at least going to an agency that makes this decision, there might be a way to determine whether that agency has been empowered by the legislature to make this kind of a decision.
Yeah, but you have an accountable figure, as Judge Ripple pointed out. I mean, both to the legislature, perhaps if some states have recall capacity.
We had accountable figures in Chadha, and the United States Supreme Court said that was unconstitutional because it violates structure. We had an accountable figure in the line item veto case, the President of the United States. The United States Supreme Court said that was structural, and it overturned it. Accountable figure doesn't make it when you're dealing with basic core structural changes. I mean, that would allow the government to very slowly change the structure a little over time of the state government, which is what this is, a very unusual case. Nobody's really seen anything quite like this, where Congress has done this, and it's really been ever litigated. It is totally changes the way the state government does business, and there's enough thing the legislature can do about it in reality. As long as there's a two-party system and there's a veto, the governor preserves his federal power from an intrusion by the legislature.
Well, there is the override capacity, right? And
that's theoretical, but that's backwards. That is policy backwards. Policy comes from the legislature first. Then it goes to the governor. Here we have the governor given policy powers by the Congress, and the legislature's got to try and muster two-thirds of a vote to overturn them. That's backwards.
Mr. Freebird, you complain that the governors are not constrained by any standards. And
yes.
The district court raised a point that you did not address. You can see that if Section 2719 were contingent on a majority vote of the applicant tribe rather than a gubernatorial concurrence, the case would be analogous to Curran and would presumably be constitutional. How does a majority vote by the tribe provide any more of a standard than a governor's concurrence? Because maybe standards isn't really your objection. I don't
know. There are just a very few cases on contingent legislation, and it's not, and they involve a limiting principle. And the limiting principle is that the people given the power under the contingent legislation provisions are the people who vote on the subject, are the people who are being regulated. The meat packers, the milk producers, wheat farmers, whoever, they're the ones who are, it is a form of self-regulation. And the other limiting principle is that it cannot bind people outside of the affected group, the people who are being regulated. There are just a handful of cases on this. That is why, and you don't, since it's a vote, there's no standard. It is basically a part of self-regulation. And yes, if we were to give this, the analogy is, yes, the vote of the true people or the people to be regulated would be the tribes. They're the ones who are submitting into this regulation. The governor, he doesn't fit any of those limiting principles. And listen to what the government says on the limiting principle for this doctrine. It's breathtaking. Their limiting principle is that, according to the government, Congress can require the consent of any person or entity outside of the federal government. In other words, CHADA is the only limiting principle, according to the government, a breathtaking expansion of the power of Congress to diminish the authority and unity of the executive branch of the United States. We would suggest, at a minimum, another limiting principle. After all, they agree that it has to be a person or entity outside of the federal government. In other words, structural issues such as CHADA is the only limiting principle that they have for this doctrine. We would suggest federalism as another limiting principle like CHADA. In other words, there can be, at a minimum, no utilization of this doctrine in the context of CHADA and PRITZ, federalism and separation of powers, and that this principle is not applicable in the context of the structure of any government, federal or state.
We have several federal statutes that permit the President of the United States to use the National Guard to quell civil disturbance.
Yes.
With the permission of the governor.
Yes.
Are those statutes now unconstitutional?
No, because both, first of all, the President is operating within the context of his core power as Commander-in-Chief, and governors also have core powers as the head of the National Guard. And this is probably constitutionally given to the governor. This issue is not constitutionally given to the governor.
That's a matter of Wisconsin state law.
Yes.
That's not the
Constitution.
For our purposes, that's part of the law of Wisconsin. In other words, your problem really is that you believe the governor is exceeding his powers under the state constitution. Am I right? That's your real problem.
No, that is one major facet of the federalism argument, and that is that the United States has rearranged the structure of state government. The other facet, which is a little more difficult to explain, but it is within the contours of Prince, and that is that the governor has been, and the state has been made a part of the federal bureaucracy. It is not the way, because it's part of a bureaucratic decision of the executive branch of the United States. Here we are in this court, taking a APA appeal off of a decision of the governor which bound the Secretary of Interior. How more involved in the decision-making process of the executive branch can we get? That is, Prince is really saying within all of this, in our view, you gotta keep the governor, the state officials, out of the administration process.
Well, but in Prince, they really pressed into federal service state officials. Here's, is that an equivalent analogy to get a recommendation from the governor? I mean, aren't the facts of Prince more compelling as to hands-on efforts that would have been required than we have here, Mr. Friedman?
I think that this is more compelling because it very definitely rearranges the structure of the powers of the governor. Prince did not. A constitutional officer has been given powers not to make policy, not by the legislature. And secondly, I believe, and our position is, there's no way the governor can avoid being the final decision maker on a federal matter. No way. Either by acting on and not acting or inaction. Inaction. All of these have consequences with respect to a program of the federal government. He is the final decision maker.
Let me just ask you this. The statute says, among other things, in the best interest of the Indian tribe and its members, and would not be detrimental to the surrounding community.
Yeah.
Now, would you say it would be better then just to have the elected officials to the assembly or be the only ones to decide that? Should an elected individual from Milwaukee, would he be good to decide the surrounding community?
Well, under their doctrine, they could give it to the an alderman from Milwaukee, or Chicago for that matter, or Florida. I mean, it could be anybody in the United States could be given this contingent legislation. I'm not sitting here talking about the wisdom of what happened there. I'd like to leave my light is on, but another issue not addressed by the Ninth Circuit was the trust doctrine, which is briefed. And I think this case presents it like no other case that was never raised in the Ninth Circuit. The Indian Trust Doctrine constrains Congress, and it's historical. I don't know the exact origins, but it's based upon the Indian Commerce Clause and treaties, as well as the fact that they have been conquered and are, in some sense, wards. Our position on this is very narrow, and that is that in testing the Indian Commerce Clause against an act of Congress, you have to determine whether there's a rational relationship to what Congress has done to the trust doctrine, its trust responsibilities. Here, they've given final decisional power to somebody who has no trust responsibility to Native Americans, and Governor McCallum said he didn't in his decision, denying. In addition, this could be no greater violation of trust than to say we're going to give it non-trustee. And secondly, this governor is in competition with Native Americans. His government runs a lottery. And the lottery, has been hurt by Native American gaming in Wisconsin. So he's a competitor. What greater violation of the trust doctrine that for the Congress to say we're going to give this to a non-trustee who has a conflict of interest?
Of course, that's an argument that the district court didn't allow you to amend to make.
No, that one was reached on its merits. The one that the court said we couldn't amend was whether it depends on how the statute is interpreted. And that it does the governor have a requirement to make the same two fact findings as the secretary, namely, is the governor constrained by Congress to say that they have to meet the two factual basis, and the government previously and 20 states in this case say that, and we do, that the governor has to make the decision on two factual determinations. When they presented, and we think we didn't need an amendment, we're not here on the amendment, they moved for judgment on the pleadings, it's part of the case. We put in a proposed amendment which did not add any factual allegations, it just asserted a new claim for relief, for theory of relief. We didn't have to do that.
You did a little late, though.
Mm. Well, what late? It was in
a couple years?
At the litigation stayed most of the time by the court in the District of Columbia. This process got to Madison on a motion for change of venue sometime September. We filed briefs, and we filed this motion in December. The case didn't open up until it was transferred here.
So during that stay period, was there anything to preclude presenting a legal theory?
The whole case was stayed. We had filed our motion, and the government moved for a stay because they moved for a change of venue. And besides that, it's their motion for judgment on the pleadings that we're talking about, and they have to provide response to every legal theory occasioned by the facts. We presented this theory in our reply brief to their motion exactly at the right time. The fact that we filed it with a motion for amendment was just, I must say, a kind of response on my part to hold up my pants with belt and suspenders. It wasn't necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Shilton.
May it please the court, I'm David Shilton from Department of Justice, representing the United States. We submit that making the application of a particular federal action, like taking off-reservation land acquired after the date of the act into trust for gaming purposes, making that contingent on the approval of a state governor, has been recognized as a constitutional exercise of legislative power since the 1930s. In the Curran case and the Rock Royal case. Those cases, of course, involve the concurrence of private producer associations, but I think the constitutional issue is really easier here, where it is the governor as an elected, accountable official who represents the interests of the state. And Congress here, quite rationally, felt that the states had very strong interest in proposals to initiate gaming on land taken into trust when it's off of the reservation. And so I think it was quite rational to give the governor this concurrence function. And I don't think any of the cases relied upon by the tribe, such as Chadha and Prince, in any way cast doubt on cases like Curran and Rock Royal, or the Celeste case from the Ninth Circuit, which applied Curran and Rock Royal. Chadha, of course, was a case within the federal government. It was an aggrandizement case where Congress was taking away power from the executive branch. We don't have that kind of problem here. Plus, Chadha was a case where Congress could review every decision the Attorney General made. Here, this is simply when there's a particular proposal in a state, the governor is given the opportunity to concur, so it's on a very occasional basis. The governor is not being forced to take over a federal regulatory program. That was, of course, the problem in the Prince case, where the Brady Act required states to in effect, take over regulation of gun registration.
Must he address the same specific criteria that the secretary must address under the statute?
In our view, no. The governor simply concurs in the secretary's determination, but I don't think that that implies that in doing that, the governor can only consider the same two factors that the secretary does. And I think it would be odd, or perhaps there should be an implication that Congress does not normally try and constrain what is considered by a state governor. These are separate sovereigns, and so I think it would be very odd if Congress tried to tell a governor you can only consider X, Y, and Z, and I don't think the Act indicates that that's what Congress was...
Strange wording, though.
Well,
the word determination is used pretty specifically.
It could be clearer, I agree, but I think, why would Congress have the governor make the exact same determination? I mean, the very reason for having gubernatorial concurrence is that Congress recognized...
Different perspective.
Different perspective, and states may see things very differently than the Secretary of Interior.
Even under the same criteria, though.
Well, that's possible, too, but...
The Secretary says, hey, this is the way it looks to me, and the governor has a chance to say, well, I don't think that, from my perspective on those criteria, it's not the same. That sounds like a good decision-making process, doesn't it?
Well, I think unless Congress is very clear in limiting the governor's discretion, that we shouldn't find that in the statute unless it's very clear, and I don't think we've got that.
Even if we, if I may follow up, sure. If we, even if we were to accept that the governor had to follow the same criteria, would that necessarily make his action reviewable under the APA?
No, because the APA only makes reviewable agency actions, and the governor, of course, is not an agency. So the only action that can be reviewed in this case is the secretary's determination, and I don't think there's any indication in the statute that the secretary somehow had to review the basis for the governor's determination. This issue, as Mr. Freibert mentioned, was only brought up at the very, very end of this case.
That was my other question. Well, I found it very hard to see how you guys were really prejudiced by that suggestion of a motion for a late amendment. I mean, this we're not sitting here with a jury or something. And it was, well, how were you prejudiced by they're wanting to add this issue?
Well, I think there's prejudice any time that a plaintiff is allowed to brief a case on the merits and hold in reserve a claim, and then when it appears that...
But was really, is that a good appropriate characterization of this, that they were holding it in reserve, or is this really something that became apparent because of the course of the litigation? This issue ought to be addressed as well.
I think the only thing that became apparent is that the constitutional claims were not likely to succeed, and that's when they brought this claim out of reserve. And I think there is a prejudice. It would have had to go through another cycle of briefing. And when the plaintiffs moved to a conditional motion to amend their complaint, at that point, they were arguing it as a 28 U.S.C. 1983 claim against the governor. They've later dropped that, and I think in their motion for reconsideration before the district court, reframed the issue as they're framing it here, that it's really a claim, an APA claim against the secretary, that the secretary should have somehow looked at the bases for the governor's decision. But that was really late. In any event, I don't think it really makes much of a difference in the end. That statute requires that there be a concurrence by the governor for the proposal to go ahead.
How do you respond to the tribe's complaint that because the statute does not impose standards on the state governors, they're free to veto gaming for reasons that are contrary to federal policy, or arbitrary reasons, or even reasons, that might be born of a racial animus. I mean, if the governor of Wisconsin gave us his reason, a racially discriminatory motive, what recourse would the tribes have?
I think that their recourse would be in state court against the governor. Basically state issues, but I think as for the constitutionality of the statute, Congress could reasonably conclude that as a general matter, governors would properly act in these situations, wouldn't act out of improper motives, and so really it would be, I think, improper to strike down a federal statute as unconstitutional just because in some unusual instance, perhaps a governor might apply improper criteria.
If the governor explicitly did apply an improper criteria, a constitutionally improper criteria, would the secretary be obliged to accept that? Could he accept it?
Well, if the governor applied a constitutionally improper criteria in non-concurring, then secretary would essentially make the same decision as here, that the proposal can't go forward. The secretary can't say, well, I'm going to decide for the governor that he should have concurred. The lack of a concurrence, whether it's silence, whether it's a one-line email, or however it's done, blocks the proposal.
Even an unconstitutional one. One based on racial discrimination, one based on religious discrimination.
Well, if it's facially clear on the face of it that I suppose the secretary could say that I see the view of non-concurrent, but I think it's on improper grounds. The secretary could find that, I suppose, but I don't see what difference it would make in the end, because you still have a lack of concurrence. Now, if the governor
had an unconstitutional basis of.
Now, if the governor had relied on an unconstitutional basis in concurring, that would be a different matter, because then the secretary has to choose, do I accept that concurrence or not? And if it's facial, then, you know, I suppose it would be appropriate for the secretary to say, well, I'm just not going to accept that concurrence. But this statute requires a concurrence for the proposal to go forward. And I don't really think that this is a case of that it's a delegation case at all. Having a contingency like this, as the Supreme Court found in Curran and Rock Royal, is not a delegation of federal legislative authority to whomever gets the concurrence power. It's simply Congress putting a condition on its own work, saying that it will allow gaming only in this limited circumstance.
Let me just go back for a minute. The tribe point out that this provision gives the governor veto power over the existence of a competitor because the state sponsors, lotteries, and these casinos would be competition. How do you respond to that?
Well, a governor has to represent all the citizens of his or her state, and they're going to be conflicting interest in the process of doing that. So the governor on a day-to-day basis has to try and be fair to all citizens, even though the state may be running an enterprise that's in conflict. So I don't think it's irrational for Congress to decide that the governor can weigh and balance those conflicts and do that in a fair way. I think what I'm hearing from the tribes there is a substantive due process challenge to Congress's decision to give the concurrence authority to the governor whose state may be running a lottery. But I think if there had been a substantive due process claim made, which there wasn't, that the statute would survive the rational basis test, just because a governor normally has to balance those conflicting sorts of interests. And then on the trust matter, as we've said, that no case has ever struck down a federal statute just purely on a trust basis. There has to be some violation of a provision of the Constitution, and the cases that the tribe has cited in that respect, the Delaware Tribal Business Committee versus Weeks and Morton versus Mancarrier, were equal protection cases, but the tribes have not maintained their equal protection.
Just as there is some limitation on the Congress's power under the Commerce power, there must be a rational basis, at least. Isn't there some kind of constraint, some limitation on the so-called Indian Commerce power as well?
Well, Yes, if an equal protection or due process challenge is brought, there would be. But if it were simply a challenge which said that Congress was acting outside of its power under the Indian Commerce Clause, then I think it would simply be a question of whether the particular statute indeed implicated Indian interests.
What would be the standard of review in that case?
Well, I think it would be a rational basis.
So you're at least willing to admit there is a rational basis limitation on the exercise of the commerce, of the Indian commerce power, as there is of the national commerce power.
I think that would be correct, but the tribe here really is not attempting to argue that Indian
gain. No, but there are passages in your brief which suggested to us that you were arguing that somehow the Indian commerce power was broader than the national commerce power, and I would hate to see that seep into an opinion around here.
While the power is plenary, as the case has said, presumably there's a limit that's judicially reviewable. But the tribes here have not tried to argue that Indian gaming is outside of the Indian Commerce Clause. It's plainly within it, as the Supreme Court held in the Cabazon case.
Well, then what really is your interpretation of the appellant's contention here? What are they trying to? What's the point they're trying to make here? I must say I found this particular point particularly puzzling in the brief.
Well, I think that the main contention they're trying to make is that this statute puts the governor in a position of really being a superior to the secretary and reviewing the secretary's determination, and therefore that's offensive to the secretary's executive branch power.
Under the trust... it's the trust power.
I'm sorry.
I understand the rest.
All right. Yeah. Under the trust power, I think their contention is that in this particular case, where the governor has not concurred and their proposal can't go forward, that's unfavorable to the tribe, and that somehow Congress can only act in a way that is favorable to tribal interests.
So in other words, Congress is not allowed to balance its obligation both to the tribe and to the rest of the population.
That seems to be the argument that's being made. But the Supreme Court, in the Cabazon case, made clear that Congress can legislate even with respect to on-reservation gaming, and indeed it has. Certainly with respect to off-reservation gaming, Congress is not disempowered from acting in a way that balances the interests of the tribes, of the state, and so forth.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Shilton. Mr. Bellavia?
May it please the Court, my name is Thomas Bellavia from the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I'm here today to represent Governor James Doyle of Wisconsin and the state of Wisconsin.
The tribe wondered aloud in their brief which branch of the Wisconsin government is controlling the position of the state here. Can you answer that? It was at page 37, footnote 24. Did you notice that?
Controlling the position in this litigation, I will frankly concede that we have consulted only with the governor's office and not consulted with any representatives of any other branch of the state of Wisconsin in preparing this litigation. The state defendants are separately arguing on this appeal only two of the issues in the case. One of those is this question about the tribe's claim that the governor concurrence provision reorders the constitutional structure of state government. And the other is the question of whether, if the concurrence provision is invalid, it can be severed from the rest of the statutory section of which it forms a part. On the latter severability issue, the state disagrees both with the federal defendants and with the tribe, and because we stand alone on that question, I did want to address it, even though it hasn't been addressed yet here today. I will not repeat what's in the brief on this point, but I would like to respond to a couple points that the tribes made on severability in their reply brief to this court. First, the tribes contend that the state defendant's position on severability would lead logically to striking down IGRA in its entirety. I think that's really a red herring of an argument. The state defendants have simply argued that the section in question, section 25 U.S.C. 2719b1a, would not have been enacted by Congress with the provision allowing the Secretary of the Interior to approve off-reservation gaming, but without the provision requiring the concurrence of the governor of the affected state. It in no way follows from that other unrelated provisions of IGRA dealing with on-reservation gaming would be stricken down. It would follow only that the entirety of section 2719b1a would fall if the governor concurrence provision falls, in order to remain consistent with Congress's intent.
Mr. Melfi, your client, the governor, does he have the authority under the laws and constitution of the state to reply to the secretary?
We contend that he does, but I would add that is, as the court mentioned earlier in this argument, that really is a state law question that doesn't determine the validity of any provision in a federal statute. And there's nothing in the federal statute that prevents, first of all, there's nothing that prevents the legislature of the state of Wisconsin from limiting or structuring the governor's discretion to concur or not concur in whatever way it pleases. And on that point, I would note that the vetoed provisions that were referred to earlier, the vetoed Wisconsin bills, don't change the matter in my view. The requiring the state legislature to follow the legislative procedures that are required under the Wisconsin Constitution, including the overriding of veto if necessary, doesn't interfere in the functioning of Wisconsin state government. It carries it out.
Is there a recall provision in Wisconsin Constitution for the, can the governor be recalled?
I'm not 100% sure, but I read a newspaper article threatening it recently, so it might be possible.
You have a provision for senators, right? So probably you have one for governor.
I think we do, but an attempt to recall
a senator? Almost 50.
I'm not sure.
You're not sure?
I've
never heard of the recall of Senator McCarthy?
McCarthy.
Okay. Then we do.
Do you read the federal statute as in any way forbidding the governor from consulting or actually deferring to the legislature and simply communicating the legislature's view to the secretary?
Not in any.
What Wisconsin law were to require? For instance, if the Wisconsin legislature did enact a statute, presumably over the governor's veto, saying if you are any inquiry made by the secretary on this matter, you shall communicate that to the legislature, and the legislature will give you an answer, which you will then communicate to the secretary. Would there be any reason why the federal law wouldn't allow that procedure in the state?
I don't think there would be any problem at all. I think that the federal statute leaves the state entirely free to do that.
Wisconsin can get its own act together however it wants.
I believe that it can, and for that reason, there isn't any interference with the operation of state government.
On the severance issue, it seems to me that we could strike the governor's concurrence provision alone and leave the rest of the statute intact. That is, we could leave the final decision in the hands of the secretary, who, of course, is obliged to take the views of the state into account. Would that result be unconstitutional, or would it simply be distasteful to the state?
Neither. It would not be an unconstitutional result, but in addition to being distasteful to the state, it would also be inconsistent with Congress's intent in Section 2719B1A. With regard to off-reservation gaming by tribes, as opposed to on-reservation gaming, it's the state's position that state interests were given greater weight in the off-reservation context, and that Congress's intent, as demonstrated both by the plain language and the logic of Section 2719, and as demonstrated by the legislative history, clearly was to not permit off-reservation gaming to be forced on an unwilling state. If the concurrence clause of that section were stricken alone, leaving the Secretary's power to make an approval decision in place, then it would be possible for the Secretary to consult with state officials, as the statute does also require, but then to disregard or to override, even if they objected, to require that the off-reservation gaming be allowed. And that is the possibility that Congress didn't permit in the statute, in the statute that it enacted. Now, there is one point closely related to this that the tribes have made that I think is an important one. So let me address it. They contend in their reply brief that a failure by this court to narrowly sever the concurrence clause alone would thwart Congress's intent to allow off-reservation gaming where the state governor does concur. Now, there is an element of truth in that statement, but it's a very incomplete characterization of Congress's intent in Section 2719. I think the more complete characterization would be a sentence like the following. Congress wanted to allow off-reservation gaming if the governor concurred, but Congress did not want to allow off-reservation gaming if the governor does not concur. Now, if you strike from that sentence the two if clauses related to governor concurrence, because that's by hypothesis invalid, then what would be left of that is the following. Congress wanted to allow off-reservation gaming, but Congress did not want to allow off-reservation gaming. Clearly, there are just simply two conflicting congressional desires. Now, as I've said, it is our position that in the off-reservation context, greater weight was given to the state side of that equation. And there is no evidence that Congress ever intended to allow tribes to use off-reservation gaming, as opposed to on-reservation gaming, as a tool for tribal development unless the state governor agreed. In the on-reservation context, it's a different story. There, the tribal interest in using gaming as a tool of tribal development was the overriding interest. But the question of how Congress might have rebalanced those two competing interests when it enacted IGRA, if it hadn't been able to use the governor concurrence mechanism, is not one that this court should be deciding as part of this case. It's entirely possible that Congress would have chosen to devise a different mechanism to allow off-reservation gaming where the state agrees, without ever forcing an unwilling state to accept off-reservation gaming. Now, let me also quickly address the question of the severability clause in IGRA. The tribes contend that narrow severance of the concurrence clause alone is required because IGRA has an express severability clause. This point is discussed in the briefs, but I would like to add that an express severability clause is entitled to less weight when the provision that's being invalidated is one that qualifies or limits the substantive scope of another related statutory provision. Now, this is the point that's discussed in our brief in relation to this court's decision in the Mills case. The principle that when you invalidate a qualifying or limiting provision, it should not be made inoperative in a way that would expand the substantive scope of the provision that was being qualified or limited. And I believe that it follows from that principle that an express severability clause is entitled to less weight when that's the kind of provision that's being invalidated. And it does not follow, as the tribe suggests, that this means that express severability clauses are meaningless, because many other kinds of provisions can be invalidated other than qualifying and limiting provisions. So there still could be very good reason for having that clause there. In addition, the tribes try to distinguish Mills on the ground that Mills itself didn't present a severability question. I think that argument fails. The underlying principle will apply whenever a provision of a statute is invalidated. The fact that it might apply in some cases that don't present a severability question doesn't mean that it does not apply in cases that do present a severability question. In addition, in the Mills decision, this court understood that the principle it was relying on did apply in severability cases, because the cases that it cited in support of that principle included several cases that did involve severability, and in one of those cases the court actually had declined to sever a provision in spite of the presence of an express severability clause, relying on this principle about limiting or qualifying provisions in a statute. Now, let me just return to the question about the reordering of state government, the other issue. This is really a state law issue that doesn't provide a basis for invalidating the concurrence provision in a federal statute. But certainly, the tribes cannot be maintaining that the governor concurrence provision is facially invalid, because there could be states that allow the governor to act under the provision, and other states that do not. So it could only be as applied to one state or another, and it would turn on state law. So it's appropriately addressed, as has been suggested earlier by the court, to the courts of the state. I also think the claim fails as the judge has said here today in argument. It is really a part of their broader federalism argument. And I think it really fails for the same basic reason that their entire federalism argument fails, which is that the concurrence provision doesn't commandeer anybody in state government to do anything. It leaves the state entirely free to operate however it pleases.
Thank you, Mr. Delahue. Mr. Freeberg, your time had expired, but I'm going to give you an additional 3 minutes.
I'd like to answer one of the questions that Congress has, the General Commerce Clause and the Indian Commerce Clause. The United States Supreme Court of Sioux Nation, which is cited in the brief, says that Congress can have two hats, but it can only wear one at a time. So in amalgamating all of that, we can't go to the General Commerce Clause regulation when we're dealing with Indian law. And that's what this is. So we're wearing the Indian Commerce Clause hat, and it's going to, I believe, have to be tested that way. And in that way, our position is that they are a trustee, and as a trustee, they cannot give the they can do almost whatever they want, except that they have to make the decision. They can't give the final power to somebody who is not in a trust relationship. And everybody in the Department of Interior is in a trust relationship. The president's in a trust relationship. The entire government of the United States. But the governor isn't, and neither is the state of Wisconsin.
Is it your view that the government is always obliged to act as a fiduciary for the tribes, even when passing general legislation? Is that your view?
No. When they're dealing within the context of Indian law, when they're operating that way, and I think that was the two-hat analysis. They have two hats, but when they're dealing with Indians, if they're wearing the Indian hat, then they have to be. It gets tested. It's a very broad test. I mean, it's a deferential test. But if that doesn't violate it, what will? The final decision maker has no trust relationship and is a competitor. It's not due process, it's trust relationship. not substantive due process, the violation of the trust relationship, to give the final decision to somebody who does not have, who's in a conflict.
Could it be interpreted, Mr. Freeburg, that Congress, in examining the trust relationship that's imposed upon it, imposed upon the country, determines that a governor's voice in off-reservation gambling is a fair exercise of the trust relationship. Not so much the reorder. I understand your reordering argument and the structure, yeah. But that would be, in Congress's view, an appropriate response.
The governor has a voice. The part of FIGRA, just the little sentence before, the one that we're dealing with, requires the secretary to seek the input of state officials and local officials. There is great deference. The difference is who's the final decision maker, and that we believe the trust doctrine means that the final decision maker on affairs involving Indians, the plenary power, is the power is in the government, not to the state official. One other thing, I think it is reviewable under the APA and under CHADA as they defined it in that context. Everything upon which the final agency decision is made is reviewable. And thank you very much for the extra time.
You're quite welcome. Thank you, Mr. Freeburg. Thank you, Mr. Shelton, Mr. Ballavia. The case is taken under advisement.